Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively into the winter months, into the post-Super Bowl time. Don Mohler, it's 11 months later. I still got my pajamas on, but at some point, I'm going to put on some proper sweatpants and head over to State Fair, grab some chicken and waffles here. Man, they've been trying to get me in with the Portales menu. My wife's talking curbside, and they're doing these incredible tequila things over at El Guapo. So I got to get out there. We got to get the shot, get everybody masked up. We're on all of that. We appreciate all of our sponsors, including our friends at Fadley's, that at Lexington Market, where I curbside some tilapia recently, curbside some steak fish or hake fish that my mom used to bread up and fry, and we did it up right off the internet. It was delicious, and my wife doesn't even like fish, but she's learning to love fish because Damie's making her do that. Don, we are now into the season where we're doing impeachment stuff, we're doing Biden stuff, we're doing let's look forward and vaccine and all of that. But it always comes back to journalists around here, doesn't it? For you, that's why you still like me all these years. You still think I work at the newspaper? I must know something.
Well, here's what I know about you, Nestor. If I don't have at least one outstanding journalist on a month, you're going to go, what the heck are you doing, dude? So once a month, at least, we have an outstanding journalist because you love journalism. And today, I can't think of someone with a better or more outstanding career than our guest, Tom Linthicum, former Sun Paper reporter, editor, business executive, superstar at the Daily Record. Let me see. Professor, author. Tom, you're a renaissance man. What can I say?
Are you still cranky all these years later? Or have you become cynical through all this yet or no?
Just around the edges. But for the most part, no. I'm still not too skeptical, yes. Cynical, no.
Well, Don would tell you that, you know, I met Don in September of 1982. So you had been at the Sun a number of years at that point. And I told him I wanted to be a sports writer. I wanted to be Oscar Madison. What I really wanted to be was John Stedman. And I aired a lot of Stedman stuff last week after the Super Bowl because I have all these tapes of us back in the 90s telling old Colts 58 and 59 stories. But, man, I walked in the Sun. I'm 17 years old, 1986. And it was, I still say to my wife all the time, incredible education for a young person to be 17 years old. And there's Reg Murphy over there on the fifth floor. And I was under Jack Lemmon and Jim Day and Ernie Imhoff. And Ernie Imhoff would tell me stories about being at the Beatles press conference when they played the Civic Center. So, you know, I grew up into that almost 40 years ago now. And I take it with me. And it was the best education I could ever have, having people like you around as resources at 8 o'clock in the morning to run up to and talk to and try to learn from.
You know, my first experience in journalism was I was still in high school, and it was a career day at the Atlanta Constitution. That was my hometown. And there happened to be a member of the local Kiwanis Club, I think was doing it, who was the TV critic for the Atlanta Constitution. And I was on the school paper at the time, and so I got recommended to go with him. So he took me down to the Atlanta Constitution, spent the entire day. He said, what are you interested in? I said, sports. So he took me back to the sports department. He introduced me to the assistant sports editor. Two or three of the guys were there. He introduced me to the guy, most important, who hired high school stringers and said, hey, do you want to go out and cover games for us? And And I spent the whole day there, walked around, saw these guys talking about current events, getting in pitched arguments about what picture was going to go on the front page, you know, what the headline should say. I wrote the greatest headline in the world. No, you didn't. That sucks. Here, take it. I'm going to do this. And I was
You get your feelings hurt, man. It's an ego buster. They take one word out of your 10-inch piece, and you're like, that was a perfect word, right?
Yes, exactly. And I was so amazed with that whole culture. I didn't know that really existed. I didn't know there were jobs. I didn't know you could get paid.
You're a TV critic. They pay you to watch TV. I used to say that to Bill Carter. Look at what happened, right? Tom, I would say to you for all of that, I was a kid just loved sports, and I was at the News American for a couple of years.
Sure.
I was going to ask you at the beginning of this, when I did a little bit of research on you, you came here in 1974 coming from Atlanta. Right. Could you have imagined, we're talking, what years were you at the paper? Were you there when Martin Luther King was assassinated in that period of time as well?
No, I was there from 70 to through the end of 73.
Well, close enough. I mean, Kent State, enough. All of that, right? So you right. come to Baltimore all these years later. Can you imagine what we saw at the Capitol here 3 weeks? I mean, coming from the South and seeing what you saw to come to Baltimore, this has been a hell of a journey for someone who came from the South to the North, I would think.
Yes, very much so. I could never have imagined what I saw happen at the Capitol. Because even though I was privileged to be able to cover some of the civil rights movement, remember that whole thing was nonviolent. So you didn't see mob scenes like this. You would see a bunch of people walking down the street. Now, sometimes, you know, like if John Lewis was in the group that crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Alabama, they got attacked. So you would see that kind of violence, but you never saw a mob take over a government building or institution or a place that was sacrosanct, really, to the local culture and the local government.
Tom, you mentioned it, and I like that Nestor did a segue there into your experience in the South. And I think you mentioned you grew up in Atlanta,
right?
Reading Lewis Grizzard, right?
We all
Grizzard, yes.
Excuse me.
Lewis Grizzard.
He wrote about the Waffle House a lot, as I remember.
Yes, he did.
And Nestor loves him some waffles. There's always we say no straight lines on Baltimore Positive. But Tom, we like our guests to sort of paint a picture for those who listen about their upbringing and sort of how that upbringing led to who they were. You mentioned you were a high school kid. You ran into the Atlanta Constitution. That's not dissimilar to Nestor's story. And I'll tell you a little later.
We were both there for sports, and look what happened to us.
Yep,
I'll share with you when you're done the advice I gave to Nestor, which, of course, he didn't take much.
He told me to go be Chris Thomas is what he told me to do.
much to my chagrin, he's never taken my advice. But talk about the Linthicum household in Atlanta, what it was like, what values you learned, and how those values serve you even today.
Well, that's a tough question. The reason is that the values that I grew up with and the values I have today are polar opposites. And part of what served me was rebelling against those values, actually. It's hard to say, but I grew up in a racist household, an obvious racist household, nothing subtle about it. And their friends were racist.
Did you feel that at the time, or was that not allowed in your heart to even feel that way about your family?
I didn't feel that it was bad at the beginning, but early in school, I found out that I was very uncomfortable with those feelings. Just to give you an example, I was as a very young boy, I was shopping with my mother at a Belk Gallant store in downtown Decatur, Georgia. She was off looking for something. I was thirsty, little kid, so I see a water fountain not too far away, and I go over there, and I had a little step stool for small people like me, and I climb up there, and I started drinking the water, and all of a sudden, my mother is shrieking my name from the other side of the store, and she comes flying over there and rips me off of the little step stool, whatever, and puts me down on the floor and points at the sign. She said, "Tommy, you can't drink that water. That's for colored people. You see that sign there? This is your water over here."
It's just inconceivable. I mean, it's inconceivable.
Well,
it really
but
is.
You know, Nestor, you say, Tom, that, great, great.
But as a child, to feel like you did something wrong was always, you know what I mean, touching a hot stove, you know what I mean, literally, right?
Right.
But Nestor, it is, you know, when Tom talks, man, my mind races. And
because you're the same age, and this could have been you if you were in Decatur, right?
Well, it was me in a sense, but I've got a dichotomy. My grandmother on my mother's side was raised in Richmond, encompassing all that you might think that means. as she grew up. And as people who have listened to this show or watched what I've written over the years, they know that one of my really good friends and college classmates was former, God rest his soul, Prince George's County executive, Wayne Curry. Wayne and I met the first day at college, at Western Maryland College, became great buds forever. We used to laugh and promise not to tell stories on each other later in life. But I'll never forget, and Tom, boy, you prompted this, was Wayne came home early in my freshman year, and you know, my mother was talking to her mother and said, yeah, and I don't know how it came up that Wayne was coming home, and who knows how it came up that he was African American. And my grandmother, without even thinking about it, just like your mom grabbing you from that fountain, Tom, my grandmother says to my mother, well, where is he going to sleep? And my this is 1968 now. This isn't 1948. And my mother goes, he's going to sleep in the room with, she called me D.I., but she said, he's going to sleep in a room with D.I. She goes, what do you mean? My grandmother couldn't comprehend that this young African-American man was going to sleep in my bedroom. Now, my mother, a child of the South, a child of a mom growing up, had already moved beyond that. And I often tell the story that when people want to say, well, that's the way it was, and give people a pass, I always say, well, wait a minute now. My mom was born in 1925, right? And if my brother or I had ever even thought about using the N-word in our house, there would have been hell to pay. So not everybody lined up that way. I have other relatives that did. And I love that you're alluding to that. Tom, talk about that experience then. You're in Atlanta. There are a lot of like-minded people around, like your folks. I always remember Carville talking about his grandparents and how much he loved them. And they were as racist could be. And he talked about the fact that he had to separate that he loved, you know, grandmom and pop.
Yeah.
And just understand her. Talk about how you evolved, particularly as a teenager, looking at mom and dad and these beliefs they had, and how you worked through that.
Well, one thing that I will say is that the N-word was seldom, if ever, used in our house. So that was of some comfort to me. They would have some friends who would come over who might use it, particularly after a cocktail or two, but they did not use those words.
But the neighbors did, right?
But the neighbors did, yes. Yeah. Yes.
That was a big word in my alley where I grew up. You know what I mean? Like, I grew up in Archie Bunker 1970, so I'm familiar with this.
Tom, was your choice? I just read today, I don't know if it was in, it might have been in New York Times. I read somewhere this morning before we came on, the struggle that some of the children, adult children, you know, people in their 20s and 30s are having with moms and dads right now who, for whatever reason, over the course of a pandemic, have embraced QAnon. And it talks about the struggle that these children are having trying to explain to mom and dad, Mom, this isn't who you are. What's happening? I'm curious. Did you have discussions like that with mom and dad, or do you just say, look, I got to do my thing. They've got to do their thing. How did you handle?
I got to the point in high school, where I would challenge them on things and try to, we ate together almost every night as a family. So I would use that forum to try to bring up topics and at least question why they had certain views and explain why I didn't agree with those views. So we did at least talk about it. They thought I was being misled at school. And
you're reading those new books.
That's right. I can't say that I convinced them about anything, but we did at least talk about it.
I was going to say, Don, your grandmother probably just thought you were a hippie, right? You were 18, you're coming home from college and in 1968, right? That's what they called you, right?
Yeah, I'm sure we have such an eclectic family, I've described and written about our Sunday dinners were always big, big things. And at Sunday dinners around my grandparents' table, from the time I was 3 or 4 years old, it was fighting about politics. And one of the things that
literally a Facebook page, but just
Before right. Facebook. Right. And gotcha. Tom, I don't know if your family was like this or not, but it took my wife, Linda, a long time to try to come to grips with what the heck is happening at Sunday dinner as people are screaming over the fried chicken, because her family just chose not to even discuss those things. Mm. And I can remember, they would even, after it was all over and they were laughing, they would even recount stories all the way about arguing over Charles Lindbergh and a Lindbergh baby way back, and who was guilty and who wasn't guilty. And somebody would just pick a side, and they would just, it was like crossfire before crossfire. Was your family political, Tom?
Yes. My father was a dyed in the wool Democrat, but he was with the Dixiecrat wing of the party, if you would. Mother was, didn't talk a lot about it, but I came to find out that she was more conservative than he was, probably. I was just thinking, going back to your question about influences and on me that might have shaped me in a way. And as I'm thinking about it, it was the newspaper. Because I started working there when I was still in high school. At first I wouldn't go into the office. Then I would go into the office and they'd let me hang around and take scores over the phone and that kind of thing.
Same thing I did.
There you go.
That's exactly what I did. Moeller, 2 goals, 2 assists. That's what I did.
So keep talking about that influence, Doc, because I can see you reflecting on that.
Well, you're around smart people, right? And literally, around incredibly smart people at that point.
Right. And even those of us in sports. And they were nowhere near where my parents were on the ideological spectrum, and we would talk about things like that. And then I got a summer job as a copy boy. I was in high school. I got this job as a copy boy. And of course, one of the things that I did in those days, one of your responsibilities was, you might have encountered this, you delivered the newspaper to the various offices in the
newsroom. It every night. Me and Larry Short. You remember Larry?
I do remember Larry.
Absolutely.
And so
got the second edition over here. We got the 2 bullet. Yeah, that was it, right?
Right, right. So one of my stops was the publisher's office, and one of my stops was the editor's office. Well, the publisher in those days was a guy named Ralph McGill, who you may have heard of, who is one of my heroes. He was a crusader for civil rights. He wrote a daily, this is unheard of these days, a daily column that ran on column 1, page 1.
The voice of the newspaper, literally.
Yes, and he took a lot of grief for his stands on civil rights, but he was out there.
I bet he did in Atlanta, Georgia, in 1968, right? Literally.
Every day. The editor was a guy named Eugene Patterson, went on to be editor of the St. Petersburg Times. He was editor or managing editor of the Washington Post. He won a Pulitzer or two. McGill won a Pulitzer or two. So these were two eminent guys. And for some reason, they both took a liking to me. And I wouldn't just drop the paper off if they weren't busy. They'd say, come in here and talk about what are you doing today? And what do you see this story in the paper? What did you think about it today? And they really inspired and broadened my thinking and reinforced the notion that there was a alternative universe out there, or maybe I had been living in the alternative universe, but the real universe was out there too, with all these decisions to be made and things to be challenged and things to be changed. And a group of several people who I know, probably, I don't know, 15 or 20, as I think back on it, of us got into journalism at that time because of civil rights, and we saw a wrong, and we wanted to be part of correcting that wrong in any way that we could. And we saw that the newspaper was having one heck of a influence on that, and we wanted to be in the middle of it.
Tom Linthicum is our guest at the Baltimore Sun for many, many years, involved in journalism and free speech and all that great stuff. Big appreciation for Don Mohler for bringing him in. Also want to give a shout out to Mohler and Gary Realty, because I didn't do that at the beginning. Jeff and I had an incredible conversation about the Ravens, but more than that, about the state of real estate. You can find that out at Baltimore Positive as well. Tom, I want to bring it into, you know, current days where full disclosure, I'll give a little baseball here. Kurt Schilling, known him forever, whatever, about 4 years ago, put up a tweet about rope tree journalists, so much awesome here. It was right about that time that I felt like I didn't need Kurt Schilling in my life any longer. And Donald Trump's war on the media, war on free speech, and the alignment that we're sitting here 24 hours after the second day of the impeachment, where Fox News refused to air the testimony and the evidence to their audience. I mean, we are in an Orwellian place from where your editors were inviting your copy boy self in, or where Reg Murphy was being nice to me in 1987. We're just in a different place right now with the internet and with the death of newspapers and really the an assault on free speech right now.
Absolutely. And it's got parallels to the to that era that I was talking about as well, because I can remember going down to, well, here's how bad things were in Georgia. This would have been late 60s, early 70s. The Atlanta papers in those days had a fleet of cars, and they were marked Atlanta Journal-Constitution and whatever. And the Atlanta newspapers were, and you were supposed to drive those cars on assignment. Except if you were being sent to any place south of Macon, Georgia, and you were going to be covering civil rights of some sort, you were not to drive a company car, because it and you were targets.
So, in the era of car bombs and those type of things, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Or, you know, just you just might get if you went to a rally and you parked your car in the parking lot or whatever, you might come back and the tires would be flat, or someone had taken a baseball bat. And this never happened to me, but it happened to some of my colleagues. So that was like a an invitation almost to get your car or maybe yourself beaten up. So that sort of stuff did exist then. There are also some wild newspapers, local newspapers that were very hardcore segregationists and right wing. But what we
early versions of 4chan and whatever that site is that they shut down, Parler, right?
Yes.
Okay.
What we didn't have then, which we do have now, the newspapers effectively were the only voice then. Radio was still playing it pretty straight. It had not gone hardcore right wing.
Well, there was no talk on radio at that point. It was just news and music, right?
Right, news and music.
They're playing Elvis or whatever.
Right. I forgot where I was going with that thread.
Oh, you're talking about the 70s and being threatened as a journalist.
You were comparing it to the Trump attack on enemy of the people and fake news.
Yes. What we did, there was nothing in those days the equivalent of fake news and the equivalent of Fox, for instance. You've got this Orwellian is a good word for it, Nestor. You've got this. If you think about it, the president of the United States for the last 4 years had his own private network, right? He didn't have to send his press secretary out to make up stuff about how many people were there at the inauguration or weren't. He had an entire network with a very loyal, loud following that was willing to follow him anywhere.
Lies that could be debunked by you or me at 20, right? Like literally obvious things that have not been called to task. It really is Orwellian, right? There's
Yeah, Nestor, and there's this interesting, as you and Tom talked just recently, as we watched the impeachment testimony, I was struck, and does it speak to the point that both you and Tom are making in terms of what is truth and what is the news? And I guess people talk about it, you know, cognitive dissonance or confirmation bias. There are all kinds of terms that folks talk about. But I was intrigued that Lindsey Graham went on Fox News with Hannity the night after the most compelling of the testimony, where we see Mitt Romney running for his life, when we see terrorists within literally a few feet of being close enough to take Mike Pence out and hang him on the gallows. And Lindsey Graham, with a straight face, says to Sean Hannity, "I'm convinced that after the embarrassing testimony, outrageous testimony today, that there are more votes than ever to acquit." Now, every news account refutes that. If anything, not 17, but more Republicans were moved yesterday, some even to tears. And Lindsey, without thinking about it, Tom, goes on a major news outlet that reaches a couple of million people every night and says, "There are more votes now than ever because people were so repulsed." Now, that's patently, I don't care what people think about Nestor and my political views, that's just not true. There has to be truth, right, Tom, as a reporter? Doesn't there have to be truth?
There ultimately has to be truth. And part of what you do as a reporter, or your main responsibility as a recruiter, is to find and get and tell the best version of the truth that you can get. It's not going to be perfect because we don't live in a perfect world. But that's what you are. That's what you're supposed to do. And one of the things that journalists have fallen into, a trap we've fallen into, it's a trap of our own making, is the notion of, well, we have to get both sides of the story. Have to get both sides of the story, or get all sides of the story.
Fair and balanced, and that's the way, is what they would say, right?
Fair and balanced. That's the way we were raised, right, Nestor? I mean, we were brought up with that. Someone's going to take this
position. I see it every night. Like, when my wife watches the NBC Nightly News, and it's like 1964. You have someone stating a fact, and someone saying something outrageous from Georgia about this Marjorie batshit woman. Right. And it's like, oh, well, there's two points of view. They must be based in fact. They're not.
Exactly. And that's not what, but we were, that's been the system in journalism. And the Trump people took wonderful advantage of that. And it's now some news organizations are now getting away from that. You need to find out what the other side is saying, or other sides, if it's plural, but finding out what they're saying and deciding then to use it or to give it the same weight as the other thing is not finding the truth. It's not really serving the interests of truth. It's not what journalism, and by my definition, really is.
We are talking journalism with Tom Linthicum, formerly of the Baltimore Sun, and I've been doing all sorts of things. Don, go ahead. I know you have more.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, Tom, you're in a unique position. You and I chatted a little bit over the past week or so off the air about reporting in general, and you're in a unique position. You've been you continue to teach. You're a journalism professor at the University of Maryland. You're the president of the Maryland Delaware District of Columbia Press Association. And before we get out of here later, I want you to talk about the incredible foundation that you're involved in. But I asked you a question the other day that I meant to ask Luke Broadwater from the New York Times when he was on, and we ran out of time because I think Luke had to run to cover Nancy Pelosi. You know, who, figure that. He had a choice between Nancy Pelosi and Nestor and me, and he had to go cover the speaker. So we understand. But I wanted to ask Luke. Now, Luke went to McDonough High School here in Baltimore,
right?
And then to college, and then to Patuxent, and then to the Sun, and then to the New York Times. My question is, as a former editor, Tom, and a teacher, is reporting, are the skills that I need as a high school journalist the same as I need as an entry-level journalist and the same as you need as an editor? What do you tell your students? Is reporting?
Yes, that's exactly what I tell them. And Here's how I first learned that. I was still a newcomer at the Baltimore Sun, so it would have been, I don't know, 74, 75. It was at one of those Friday night or Saturday night newspaper parties. Nestor, you know what those are like. Small amounts of alcohol are involved.
Was my friend Mike Bowler holding court at that time?
Yes, Mike Bowler was there holding court.
Probably at the House of Welsh or at Burke's.
God rest Mike, one of my favorite neighbors, one of my favorite people. I interrupted, but anytime I get a chance to invoke the name of Mike Bowler holding court, I'm going to do so. I'm sorry, Tom.
I hope it included a frosted Mick at Burke's and some onion rings, proper crab melt.
No doubt it did. Well, there was a guy holding court there who we all wanted to talk to. His name was Fred Barbash. We wanted to talk to him because he had come up through the local staff and was now the London correspondent. And he was back on a visit. And so we wanted to say, well, what's it like in London? What's it like to be a foreign correspondent? How different is it? And he said, let me tell you guys something. He said, the reporting skills that I use on this assignment are the same ones that I learned covering cops in Baltimore. They're the same ones I polished up a little bit and used at City Hall. They're the same ones I used covering the Maryland legislature. It's the same stuff. He said they have different libel laws there. They have different social conventions and you work around that kind of stuff. But the basic blocking and tackling, the figuring out what the story is, the figuring out who the most important people are to talk to, what sources are you going to interview, what documents do you need, all of that stuff, he said, is the same.
Who, and what, where, why, when, how, that's it. To be on my tombstone, that's it. That's the Bible. That's it, right? Like, literally, report the facts, just the facts, right? Sort of Joe Friday, like the same sort of police skills, right?
Well, Tom, if you were an editor today, then applying that standard, boy, it's got to be tough today. But if you're an editor today and you're trying to follow this story that is unfolding now, what are you banging on your reporters to do and to try to focus on and to try to get a handle on? Tom Linthicum, editor, what are you doing?
You're talking about the impeachment stuff?
Yeah, what we've seen in the United States over the past 9 to 12 months. What are you beating on your reporters to do?
I'm beating on them to find these people who are Trump supporters and talk to them about the why. Try to understand what is going on, because you can't really write about it except in the most superficial way until you can understand what's in their heads. What do they believe?
Tom, I've called it intellectual dishonesty. Like, and I think at the heart of it, anytime I see Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio speak, there's an intellectual Newt Gingrich. There's something so patently dishonest about it that it's almost sinister in its cruelty and its dishonesty. And that's the part that I've struggled with.
Nestor, I think Tom, and Tom, pick up on this if I'm wrong, I think Tom is alluding to something else. And that something else for me is what I think people are finding so difficult, Tom. And that is, I haven't seen anybody really capture it well. I think you're suggesting to try to find out what is happening in the mind of the man and woman on the street who's buying into the intellectual dishonesty that Nestor's talking about. Is that
what they're believing? Things that aren't true because they've watched. I mean, let's talk about Fox News. I mean, this is really the genesis of this, right? Fox News reinforces every night, still last night, reinforcing whatever the big lie or Joe Biden would call it, but the ideology, right?
Right. And it's not just Fox News. Now you've got these pretenders to Fox News. What, the One America Network and then what's the other one? Newsmax or whatever it is.
Newsmax. Yeah. Yeah, Newsmax recently, if anyone turned it on to watch any of it during the impeachment testimony, Newsmax goes way to the right of Fox, basically presenting it. And again, if you're one of the hundreds of thousands or maybe now in the millions who are watching Newsmax, you believe that Jamie Raskin himself is leading a rebellion against the United States. It is. There are two different universes out there that appear to me to be very, very challenging. Tom, I'm curious. You ended up at Vanderbilt. The Commodores, I have to say.
Let's not go to football.
At first,
now.
I thought, man, they like Lionel Richie, and I go, no, it's not those Commodores. It's actually Cornelius Vanderbilt. Talk about your Vanderbilt years. Were you involved in the school paper at Vanderbilt?
Well, funny thing, yes. I mean, the answer is yes. I went there and started, got involved with the school paper, which is, for better or worse, called The Hustler. And
we lost Larry Flint today, so we gotta throw that out.
And I spent about a semester working with them, and there were some good people there, talented people there, who went on to very good careers in journalism. But I remember I was there one night. Hubert Humphrey had come to town on to talk on a campaign trail thing. And we had sent somebody out to cover it. I didn't have enough seniority to get that kind of a plum assignment. So I was back in the office doing scut work and whatever needed to be done. And then the reporter came back, or reporters, might have been more than one, and we had sent a photographer out there too. And I remember that the editor who was putting that story together and putting the coverage together, his instructions were to the photographer, give me the picture that makes Humphrey look the worst. And I thought to myself, really? Is this how it works? This is the way they're practicing journalism here? Is this the way they want to do it? And so I hung around. I stayed with them for about one semester. But there were other incidents that were like that. And these weren't bad people. They were just really caught up. They were passionate. But I didn't think they were doing journalism. Or if
That's
they
really,
were, they were
really.
They were doing it with advocacy journalism with a capital A. So
that's fascinating. Back, you wouldn't think that, would you, in a college paper? But it just shows you again
ideology,
the evolution of where we've been.
Well, and I mean, the person who said that was not a hardcore Republican or whatever. I mean, he didn't think Humphrey was liberal enough. He thought he was too close to Johnson. You know, he wanted a really
he wanted Bernie.
Yeah, he wanted a Bernie. I forget who else was running at that time, but
he probably wanted Gene McCarthy. He was probably one of
Clean
McCarthy. Jeans.
That,
Gene,
exactly.
Clean Jeans kids. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, Clean Jeans. Well, I joke. I said, you know, the Commodores in Vanderbilt. I said, let me see. We got Tom Linthicum, John Meacham, and Willie Geist. Man, that's a hell of a ball team there.
All I know is we could go to the Pancake Pantry around the corner there, probably do some damage down in Nashville, Tom.
Yes, that's
pretty
true.
Pretty good company. Well, Tom, you've got to – I love when people branch out. And I'm thinking, so Tom wrote a book, you know, like wouldn't everybody write a book entitled A Man Called Mark? The biography of Bishop Mark Dyer, you choose to write a book that wins all kinds of awards about a Benedictine monk from a blue-collar neighborhood who's involved in all kinds of the issues taking place in the 20s. Talk to us about when you're sitting around and you say, I'm going to write a book about a Benedictine monk. I got a hell of an idea.
This is when the show's getting good today.
Right. How do you pick a Benedictine monk and say to your family, I got a good one. I'm going to write a book on this monk.
Well, I can't take credit for that because he and his wife actually came to me. Long story, very, very short. But my wife for years has worked at Virginia Theological Seminary in Alexandria, which is an Episcopal seminary. Mark Dyer at that point in his career was on the faculty there. And I got to know him. I would somehow we would end up standing next to each other at social occasions, and we'd each have a Sam Adams, and he would start telling stories about he was an Irish storyteller, an Irish bard, and so he loved to tell stories about growing up and about things in the church and whatever. And so I heard this for a long time, and then his family came to me and said, "Mark has always wanted to write a book, but he." He's a talker. He's not a writer. Could you work with him on a book? And by then I knew what great stuff he had. So I said, yeah, sure. I could do that. Well, again, very long story short, his health unfortunately started to go downhill. There we go. Thank you. It's available on Amazon. His health started to go downhill. He had a multiple myeloma, and it became very clear very quickly that the collaboration model wasn't going to work, that I was going to have to actually do the writing, and I could get him to talk to me when he was had the strength to do that. So there I was, and he's a wonderful story because he is a again, how many people go from Benedictine monk to one of the highest ranking bishops in the Episcopal Church and are sitting down for negotiations with the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church and some of the highest ranking people in other churches? But Mark was also just an ordinary guy, again, who loved to tell stories.
Would Mark, one of the themes I'm always looking for, would Mark have been successful in any field if he weren't a monk?
You know why I think the answer is yes, is one of Mark's operating principle was life is about relationships. And this is something I have come to embrace with the passing of time in my own life. But he would try to connect with people as people, and know them and understand them and respect them. And then he could really talk to them and meet them in a different place. Sort of like what we were talking about earlier with the Trump people. How do you approach these people? How do you find out what they're really thinking? So yes, I think he would have been successful in any undertaking because of the way he got along with people. He told me once that, when he was assigned a task to do, no matter how hard it was, like go off and negotiate with the Eastern Orthodox Church for 17 years, which he did, and they actually came up with an agreement. But he said the first thing he would think about when he was given a task was not what do I have to do, but who do I know who is familiar with this topic and might be willing to work with me and help educate me. And so that's the way he approached life.
And so again, it's available on Amazon, right?
It is.
Yeah. So
come on down.
Again, go on down. A man called Mark. Again, Tom's a great writer. You know, Tom, as you talk about the Benedictine monk, I think of the other, as I said, one of the many successful Vanderbilt folks, John Meacham. I think I heard him recently, and I was thinking of this statement that he made as you described the skill set of the monk of Mark Dyer, when he said, and I think he quoted Howard Baker, former Senator Howard Baker. He said one of the things that he always remembers Baker saying to people is, you'll be surprised how much more productive the conversation will be if you start out when you disagree with someone with the premise, if you can say to yourself, you know, the other person might actually be right. And it sounds to me that part of what you're saying is that the Benedictine monk here was saying, you know, maybe the other person is right sometime.
Yes. Yes.
Tom, absolutely. We appreciate the visit. It's been great to have you.
Wait a minute, Nestor. Before we let him run, I gotta have him pitch the.
You gonna do what kind of tree you want to be?
No, I'm not gonna do the tree or the music. Or Nestor hates it when we do the James Lipton thing. But I am fascinated.
No, I don't. I just don't like the tree question.
I am fascinated by the foundation that you're involved in, and I want people to know a little bit about it. We're gonna give you oxygen to do that, and how they can get involved if they'd like. So tell us about this foundation.
Great. Thank you. It's the Maryland Delaware District of Columbia Press Foundation. We have a board of trustees, and I'm privileged to be the president of that board. And we got people on there, like the dean of the journalism school from Maryland is on it. The one of the highest deans at Morgan State University is on it. We have quite a strong group. Anyway, what we exist to do is training and education and professional development for especially aimed at young journalists. And our main weapon for doing that is internships, which are harder and harder to find in this time of declining resources in journalism. We still provide 8-week paid internships for students and who will go to a new – the students need to be from Maryland, Delaware, D.C., or attend college in Maryland, Delaware, D.C. And then we place them with one of our member organizations for an 8-week internship. I'm so proud of what happened last summer. You might remember this little thing called a pandemic was going on. We had already picked our interns when that hit, and we picked the papers they were going to. I was concerned that the whole program would fall apart for a year, that the kids would be scared to go, that the papers wouldn't want to have them there. And several newspapers around the country, big newspapers like the Boston Globe, canceled their internships last summer. We ended up doing just the opposite. We went full speed ahead. We talked to each student. They were comfortable in doing it. They were willing and eager to do it, actually, thought it would be a unique challenge. We talked to the host newspapers. Their newsrooms were all closed. Everybody was working at home. And they said, we can do this. Send them on. Yeah, we'd love to do that. And we got some of the highest rankings from the kids who went through the program than we've ever gotten. So
I want to give the websites MDDC Press, correct?
Yes, MDDCPress.com.
Now, do you have to fund this, or does the paper fund it, or do you as an organization fund it?
No, we fund it as an organization. That's why we're always in a fundraising mode, because the money that we raise goes straight to these salaries and to training for these young people as well.
Well, so you and I were beneficiaries of such a, you know, would have been beneficiaries of such a system, right? When we were kids.
We would indeed. Yes, we would.
So people talk about the importance of a free press, and we see it all the time, and certainly in our circles, people, here's a way for them to really express their support. Jump on the website that you mentioned. Nestor put it up. Really support these young journalists as they move forward. Tom, I can't thank you enough. Terrific story. Again, folks, go out and buy the book, A Man Called Mark. It's available at Amazon and other bookstores. If you read what Tom Linthicum writes, you won't be disappointed. Thanks a million. Nestor, take us out of here.
Tom, it's been a great visit. Really appreciate the kindred spirit on free speech and the media and who, what, where, why, when, and how. How about that?
It's
been a little while
since.
Did I pass the test?
Yes, sir.
I did okay on the quiz. I appreciate that. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Mueller, with a big, big shout out and thanks to our friends at State Fair, known as Portales on the romantic holidays, as well as our friends at El Guapo. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to get over there and get some tequila at this point. I am not going to drive home. I saw the Springsteen thing last week. I know you're disturbed by that, Mueller. So we're all trying to keep it clean here on the backside of Bruce this week. I am
in a day and age of Uber. You do not need to get into an automobile when you've had one too many. Thanks to Fade Leaf, to Mower and Gary. Nestor, wrap it up.
And Wayne's World, party time, party time. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. And we never stop talking Baltimore positive.